Chapter 5. A Changing World. The Queen of the Elves sat in state on a diamond throne in her palace, surrounded by her courtiers, foundlings and lost boys, and creeping creatures with no names, all the detritus of the fairy folk. She had chosen to sparkle today. The everlasting sunlight shining through the exquisitely carved stone windows had been pitched exactly to strike the tiny gems on her wings so that delicate rainbows of light danced around the audience chamber as she moved. The courtiers, lounging about the place in lace-trimmed velvet and feathers, were almost, but not quite, as beautifully dressed. Her eyes slid sideways, ever alert to the actions of her lords and ladies. Was that Lord Lankin over there in the corner with Lord Mustard Seed? Whispering? And where was Lord Peasblossom? One day, she thought, she would have his head on a pole. She didn't trust him at all, and his glamour had been strong of late, almost as glorious as her own. Or, she reminded herself bitterly, as glorious as her own had been before. Before that young witch, Tiffany Aching, had come into Fairyland and humiliated her. Lately, she had felt shivers between their two worlds, understood that things were shifting, the edges becoming more blurred, softer. A few of the stronger elves had even been slipping through from time to time for a little mischief. Perhaps soon she could lead the elves on a proper raiding party, fetch another child to play with, have her revenge on the Aching Witch. The Queen smiled at the thought, licking her lips in anticipation of the fun ahead. But for now there was other troubling news to deal with. Goblins. Mere worms who should be grateful if an elvish lord or lady even looked their way, but who were now foolishly refusing to do her bidding. She would show them all, she thought. Lords Lankin, Mustard Seed, Peasblossom. They would all see how powerful she was again. They would see her strike down this goblin filth. But where was Peasblossom? The goblin prisoner was brought into the audience chamber under guard. The whole effect was visually stunning, the goblin thought sourly. Exactly as a fairy court would look in a human child's storybook, until you looked at the faces and realised that there was something not quite right about the eyes and the expressions of the beautiful creatures in the scene. The Queen considered the goblin for a while, resting her fine-boned chin on the fingers of one exquisitely thin hand, her alabaster brow furrowed. "You goblin! Call yourself of the dew the sunlight, I believe. You and your kind have long enjoyed the protection of this court. Yet I hear talk of rebellion, a refusal to do my bidding. Before I hand you over to my guards for their amusement, tell me why this is." Her melodious voice was rich with charm as the words were spoken, but the goblin seemed unmoved. He should have fallen to his knees and begged for her forgiveness, hypnotized by the power of the Queen's glamour, but instead he stood his ground stockily and grinned at her. Grinned at the Queen. "Well, Queen, it's like this, you see. Goblins is now treated as upright citizens in human world. Humans say goblins useful. We likes being useful. We gets paid for being useful and finding out things and making things." The Queen's beautiful visage slipped. She glared at the cheeky creature in front of her. "That's impossible," she shouted. "You goblins are the dregs. Everyone knows that." "Ha-ha," laughed the goblin. "Queenie not so clever as she thinks. Goblins riding on hog's back now. Goblins know how to drive the iron horses." There was a shiver in the court as the goblin uttered the word iron, and the magical glimmer dimmed. The Queen's dress changed colour from silver gossamer to blood-red velvet, and her blonde ringlets turned into straight, raven-black locks. Her courtiers followed suit as the pastel silks and lace made way for leather breeches, scarlet sashes and scraps of fur over woad-covered torsos. Elven stone knives were drawn and sharp teeth bared. The little goblin did not flinch. "I don't believe you," said the Queen. "After all, you are just a goblin." "Just a goblin, yes, your queeniness," he said quietly. "A goblin what understands iron and steel. Steel as goes round and round and chuffs. Takes people to faraway places. And a goblin what is a citizen of Ankh-Morpork. And you know what that means, my lady. The Dark One there gets upset when his citizens get killed." "You are lying," said the Queen. The Lord Vetinari would not care what happens to you. You goblins always lie, of the dew, the sunlight. Not my name any more. I am now of the lathe, the swarf, said the goblin proudly. Swarf, said the queen, what is that? Itty bits of iron, these, queenie, said the goblin, his eyes hardening. Of the lathe, the swarf, no liar. You talks to me like that again, your magisteriousness. I opens my pockets. Then we sees what swarf is. The queen drew back, her eyes fixed on the goblin's hands hovering near the pockets of his dark blue jacket, wooden toggles fastening it over his skinny chest. You dare threaten me, she said. Here, in my own realm, you worm, when I could shrivel your heart within you with just a word? Or have you dropped where you stand? She gestured to the guard standing ready with their crossbows aimed at the goblin. I is no worm for you, Queenie. I have the swarf, tiny bits of steel that can float in the air. But I is here to bring news, a warning. Of the lathe, the swarf still has fancy for the old days. I likes to see humans squirm, likes to see you fairy folk stirring things up, I does. Some goblins thinks as I does, but not so many now. Some goblins almost not goblins now, almost human. I don't likes it, but they says the times these are changing. The money is good, you see, Queenie. Money, sneered the queen. I give you goblins money, you... She paused as she saw the goblin's hand move into his pocket. Could the horrible little creature really be bringing iron into her world? Iron, a terrible substance for any of the fairy folk. Painful, destructive. It blinded, deafened, made an elf feel more alone than any human could ever feel. She finished her sentence with gritted teeth. Worthy creature. Gold as melts away as sun rises, said the goblin. They, we, gets real money now. I just wants goblins to remain goblins, goblins with status, respect, not pushed around no more by you or anyone else. He glared at Peaseblossom, who had suddenly stepped to the side of the queen. I don't believe you, said the queen. Your funeral, Queenie, said the goblin. Don't believe me. Go to gate. Not so much trouble now, old witch gone. You sees for yourself. World has changed, Queenie. And the queen thought, changed, yes. She had felt the tremors, known something momentous was afoot, but not known exactly what. So the old witch was gone. With no hag to stop them, why, she realised, we can ride through in splendour once more. Then her face fell. Except for this swarf, this iron. Bind this maggot's arms behind him, she ordered her guards, pointing at the goblin. I wish to see if he speaks true. And he will ride with us, she smiled. If he speaks false, we will tear out his tongue. Next morning, alone in Granny Weatherwax's cottage, her cottage now, Tiffany woke early, knowing that her world had changed. You was watching her like a hawk. She sighed. It was going to be a busy day. She had been in many houses where death had recently visited, and always the lady of the house, if there was one, would be shining anything that shined and cleaning everything that could be cleaned. And so, with rags and polishing cloths, Tiffany Aching cleaned everything that was already spick and span clean. It was a kind of unspoken mantra. The world had gone bad, but at least the grate had been polished and now had a fire ready to light in it. All the time, like a statue, there was you staring at her. Did cats know about death, she wondered? What about the cats of witches? Especially, what about Granny Weatherwax's cat? Tiffany tidied that thought away for now and started on the kitchen, burnishing anything that could be burnished, and yes, it shone. She was cleaning things already clean, but the algebra of mourning required the effort of getting all the death out of the house, and there was no shrinking from it. You cleaned everything regardless. She'd finished in the kitchen and the scullery, leaving everything so bright that her eyes watered, and then there was nothing for it but to go upstairs. On her hands and knees, with bucket and brush and rags and grease, that is, elbow grease, Tiffany cleaned and cleaned until her knuckles were red and she was satisfied. But that wasn't the end of it. There was Granny's small wardrobe, with its few well-worn and serviceable dresses hanging in there, along with a cloak. All black, of course. Tucked away on a shelf was the Zephyr Billow cloak Tiffany herself had given Granny, unworn as far as she could see, but kept carefully like a special possession. She felt her eyes begin to prickle. Beside the bed were Granny Weatherwax's boots. Good, serviceable boots, Tiffany thought, and Granny had hated waste. But to actually wear them... She was going to find it hard enough to follow in Granny's footsteps. She swallowed. She was sure she could find a good home for the boots. In the meantime, well, she poked forward a toe and pushed them out of sight beneath the bed. Then, of course, there was the kitchen garden and, above all, the herbs. Tiffany found a pair of heavy gloves in the scullery. You didn't go into Granny's herbs without heavy gloves until they knew you. Granny had foraged, bartered, and been given herbs from just about everywhere, and she had rotating spinach and doubting plums, ginny-come-nether, twirlabout, tickle-my-fancy-root, jump-in-the-basin, and jack-go-to-bed-and-never-get-up, daisy-upsy-daisy, and old-man-root. There was a clump of love-lies oozing by the jack-by-moonlight, and a very active maiden's respite. Tiffany did not know what all of them were for. She would have to ask Nanny Og, or Magret Garlic, who, like her husband Verence, the King of Lanka, was very enthusiastic about herbs. Basically, if it had something herbal in it, Magrat and Verence thought it would do you good. With some of the herbs in Granny's garden, this might be doubtful, at least in the short term, and it might not be wise to stray too far from the privy. Though, unlike her husband, Magrat did actually know her troubling Tony from her multitude route. It was never easy being a witch. Oh, the broomstick was great, but to be a witch you needed to be sensible, so sensible that sometimes it hurt. You dealt with the reality, not what people wanted. The reality right now was suddenly you, meowing and banging her head against Tiffany's legs, demanding food, which she then ignored completely when Tiffany went back into the kitchen and placed a dish of it down for her on the floor. Tiffany went outdoors again and fed the chickens, let the goats out to graze, had a word with the bees, and then thought, I've done my bit. The place is spotless, the bees are happy, even the lean-to is clean. If Nanny can come in and feed the animals, keep an eye on you, then I can go back home for a few days. Reaching the chalk after a flight that was long and, sadly, very wet, since the rain was teeming down, and, contrary to popular belief, no witch Tiffany knew had yet managed to control a broomstick whilst also using an umbrella, she flew to the house of young Millie Robinson, the Feagles clinging on behind, under, and actually on her in their usual style. Millie's two baby boys looked well fed, but the little girl, baby Tiffany, didn't. Unfortunately, witch Tiffany was used to this sort of thing, especially when the mothers weren't very clever or had bossy mothers and thought feeding the boys was the main thing in life. It was why, just after the baby's birth, she had whispered that spell into the baby's ear. A simple tracking magic, so she would know if any harm befell the little girl, just a precaution, she had told herself at the time. There was no use getting nasty about all this, so she took the young woman aside and said, Millie, listen. Yes, your boys have to be straight and strong when they grow up, but my mother always used to say to me, your son's your son until he takes a wife, but your daughter is your daughter all of your life. And I think that's right enough. You help your mother out still, don't you? And she helps you. So fair shares for the little girl is the right thing to do. Please. Then, because the carrot, or in this case the breast milk, sometimes needed to be accompanied by the stick, she added sternly, the pointy hat making her seem older and wiser than she would otherwise appear, I shall be watching after her interests. A little bit of menace often did the trick, she had learned, and of course she would watch. Then there was only one person she wanted to talk to, and the rain was getting harder still as her stick drifted down towards the Feagle Mound on the hill, Rob and the other Feagles toppling off as she approached. Daft Woolly made a spectacularly bad landing, head first into the gorse, and a rabble of young Feagles rushed up joyously to unscrew him. There were a couple of Rob's older sons lounging around outside the entrance. They were scrawny, even by Feagle standards, with barely a wisp of beard hair between them and impractically low-slung spogs knocking about their knees. Their kilts hung low on their skinny hips. To Tiffany's amazement, she could see the top bands of coloured pants riding high above them. Pants? On a Feagle? The times were indeed changing. "Pull yon kilts up, lads," Rob muttered as they pushed their way past. The Kelder was in her chamber, surrounded by Feagle babies, all rolling around on a floor covered with the fleeces of sheep gone to another land. And the first words she said were, "I know," she sighed, and added, "it's grieving I am, but the wheel takes all in time." Her face crinkled into a huge smile. "It's happy I am to see you as leader of the witches, Tiffan." "Well, thank you," said Tiffany. How did Jeannie know, she wondered for a moment, but every Kelder used the way of the Hidlins to see things past, present, and future. And it was a secret known only to the Kelders, passed down one to the other. She understood, too, that although Jeannie was very small, she was someone to whom she could tell every secret, and the assurance that it would never be passed on to anyone. And now she hesitantly said, "Jeannie, I don't think I could ever fill her boots."
"Really?" said the Kelder sharply. "Didn't you think Esmeralda Weatherwax may nae have kenned the same thing when the position was gien to her? Do you suppose yon hag then said, 'Nay, me, I'm nae good enough'?"
The wise little Pixie was looking at Tiffany as if she was some kind of specimen, a new plant, perhaps. And then she lowered her voice and said, "I ken well enough that ye will be a good leader." "Though only the first amongst equals, rather than a leader," Tiffany added. "At least, I'm sure that's what the other witches think." Her voice trailed off, her doubts hanging in the air.
"Is that so?" said the Kelder.
She went quiet for a moment, then said softly, "Ye who kissed the spirit of winter and sent him packing, aye? Yet I ken that ye have in front of ye something less easy, Tiffan. There is a change coming in the heavens, and ye will need to be there." Her voice grew even more sombre, and her small eyes were fixed on Tiffany now.
"Be aware, Tifaheen, this is a time of transition," she said. "Mistress Weatherwax is nae longer wi' us, and her going leaves a hole that others will nae fail to see. We must watch the gateways, and ye must take great care, for them ye don't wish to know might be seeking ye out."
It was good to be home, Tiffany thought, when at last she arrived there, back at her parents' farm. It was even called Home Farm, back where her mother cooked a hot dinner every night, back where she could sit at the big wooden kitchen table, which was scarred by generations of achings, and become a little girl again. But she wasn't a little girl any more. She was a witch. One with two steadings to look after. And over the next week, as she flew back and forth from the chalk to Lanker, from Lanker to the chalk, in weather that seemed to be enjoying a competition to be the wettest ever for the time of year, it seemed to her that she was always arriving late, wet and tired. People were nearly always polite, to her face anyway, and certainly to the pointy hat, but she could tell from what they didn't say that somehow, indefinably, whatever she did, it wasn't quite enough. She got up earlier every day and went to bed later, but it still wasn't enough. She needed to be a good witch, a strong witch, and in between the carrying and the healing, the helping and the listening, she could feel sudden prickles of alarm run up and down her body. Jeannie had warned her that something dreadful might be coming. Would she be up to the job? She didn't even think she was doing very well with all the usual stuff. She couldn't be Granny Weatherwax for them in Lanker, and it was getting harder and harder to be Tiffany Aching for the chalk. Even at home, even there, she struggled in wearily one night, longing for food, peace and her bed, and as her mother pulled a huge pot from the big black oven and placed it in the centre of the table, a family row was just starting. "I met Sid Pigeon outside the Baron's Arms today," her brother Wentworth, a strapping lad of not quite old enough for the pub yet, but certainly old enough to hang around outside, was saying.
"Sid Pigeon?" Mrs. Aching wondered.
"The younger of the two Pigeon brothers," her father said. Younger, thought Tiffany. That counted for a lot in farming country. It meant the older brother got the farm, though if she remembered correctly, the Pigeon farm was a pretty poor place, not very well run. Wasn't Mr. Pigeon a regular at the Baron's Arms? She tried to remember Mrs. Pigeon and failed. But yes, she remembered Sid. She'd seen him only a few weeks back up near Two Shirts, a small boy who had seemingly grown into his name when someone had given him a peaked cap and a whistle to hang around his neck. "You were telling me about them railway jobs," Wentworth went on enthusiastically. "He's earning good money, is Sid. Says they need more men. It's the future, Dad. Railways, not sheep."
"Don't get any daft ideas, lad," his father warned. "Railways is for them as don't take on land to farm. Not like us Achings, not like you. You know what your future holds for you. It's right here, where it's always been for Aching, lad."
"But..." Wentworth wasn't happy. Tiffany shot him a look. She knew how he felt. And after all, she herself wasn't doing what had been expected of her, was she?
If she had, she'd be getting married about now, like her sisters had, getting ready to produce a few more grandchildren for her mother to fuss over. Her mother seemed to be thinking of the same thing. "You always seem to be somewhere else these days," she said, changing the subject from Wentworth to Tiffany, trying hard not to sound like she was complaining. "I wish you could be with us more, Tiff," she added, a bit sadly.
"Don't bother the lass. She's some kind of top-notch witch now, you know. She can't be everywhere," her father said.
Feeling like a little girl, Tiffany said, "I try to be around here as much as possible, but we don't really have enough witches to do the work that's needed." Her mother smiled nervously and said, "I know you work hard, dear. There's lots of people who stop me in a row to say my girl has helped their kid or their father. Everybody sees that you're running about like nobody's business. And you know what people are saying? They are saying to me, you are growing up like your granny. After all, she used to tell the Baron what to do, and you do the same." "Well, Granny Aching wasn't a witch," said Tiffany.
"That depends," said her father, turning away from Wentworth, who stomped out and slammed the kitchen door behind him. Joe Aching looked after him for a moment, then sighed and winked at Tiffany. "There are surely different kinds of witches. You remember how your granny wanted the shepherd's hut burned down once she was dead? Burn everything, she told me."
He smiled and said, "I almost did what I was told.
But there was a thing she had, and it was not for the burning. So I wrapped it up, and now, seeing you, my girl, here's a little memento from Granny Aching."
To Tiffany's surprise, her father was crying under his smiles as he gave her a little package wrapped up in crinkled paper and tied with a piece of old wool. She opened it and turned the little ridged object over in her hand. "It's a shepherd's crown," she said. "I've seen them before. They're quite easy to find."
Joe Aching laughed, said, "Not this one. Your granny said it was special, the crown of crowns. And if the shepherd of shepherds picked it up, it would turn into gold. Look, beneath the grey you can see the hints of gold."
Tiffany looked at the little object while she ate her stew, made as only her mother could make it, and she thought about the days when Granny Aching would come down to the farm for a meal. It seemed to some that the old woman had lived on jolly sailor tobacco, and there was no doubt about it. When it came to sheep, Granny Aching knew everything. But the mind starts running all by itself, and Tiffany thought about all the things Granny had done and the things that Granny had said. Then the memories came as a cavalcade, whether she wanted them or not, settling on her like snow. Tiffany thought of the time she had walked with her granny. Mostly in silence, sometimes with thunder and lightning, Granny Aching sheepdogs at their heels. She had learned a lot from the old woman. "She taught me so much," she said to herself. "She built me as we were walking around after the sheep, and she told me all those things that I needed to know, and the first thing was to look after people." Of course, the other thing had been to look after the sheep. And all she had ever asked for was her shepherd's hut and some horrible tobacco. Tiffany dropped her spoon. It was all right to sob in this familiar kitchen, like she had when she was a girl. Immediately her father was there beside her.
"You can do a lot, Jigget, but no one could do it all."
"Yes," said her mother, "and we keep your bed ready every day, and we know you are doing a lot of good, and I am proud when I see you flying around. But you can't do everything for everybody. Don't go out again tonight, please."
"We like seeing our girl, but it'd be nice to see her properly, and not always in a blur," her father added, putting his arm around her.
They finished their dinner in silence, a warm silence, and as Tiffany prepared to go up the stairs to her childhood bedroom, Mrs. Aching stood and pulled out an envelope from where she had tucked it out of the way on the dresser, amongst the blue and white jars that, surprisingly, in a working farm kitchen, were simply for show. "There's a letter here for you, from Preston, I expect." Her tone was very motherish now. She only had to say Preston, and there was a question there. And Tiffany crept up the stairs, feeling the care and love of her parents flowing around her and into her room, relishing the familiar creak of the boards. She placed the shepherd's crown on the shelf by her few books, a new treasure, and pulled on her nightdress wearily. Tonight, she decided, she would try to forget her fears, allow herself to just be Tiffany Aching for a while, not Tiffany Aching, the Witch of the Chalk. Then, while there was still light to see, she read Preston's letter.
and the weariness fled for a moment, replaced by a wave of sheer happiness. Preston's letter was wonderful. Filled with new language, new words. Today he wrote about taking up a scalpel. Such a sharp, strong word. And how he had learned a new way to suture. Suture, Tiffany said quietly to herself. A soft word. So much smoother than scalpel. Almost healing. And in a way, she needed healing. Healing from the loss of Granny Weatherwax. Healing from the strain of too much to do. And healing from the effort of trying to match the expectations of the other witches. She carefully read every word, twice, then folded the letter up and put it away in a small wooden box in which she kept all his letters, as well as the beautiful golden hair pendant he had once given her. There was no point resealing it. She could keep nothing secret from the Feagles, and she preferred not to have the box full of the snail slime they used to re-stick anything they had opened. Then she slept in her childhood bedroom. Beside her there was the cat, Hugh. And Tiffany was a child again, a child with parents who loved her very much. But also a young girl, a girl with a boy who sends her letters. And a witch. A witch with a cat that was very special. While her parents lay in bed, talking about their daughter. "It's right proud of our girl I am," Joe Aching began. "And of course she is a really good midwife," Mrs. Aching said, adding rather sadly, "but I wonder if she might ever have children of her own. She doesn't talk about Preston to me, you know, and I don't much like to ask. Not like with her sisters," she sighed. "But so much is changing. Even Wentworth tonight."
"Oh, don't worry about him," Mr. Aching said. "'Tis right for a lad to want to find his own feet, and most likely he'll bluster for a bit and shout and argue, but he'll be here when we've gone, looking after the aching land, you mark my words. There is nothing to beat land," he sniffed. "Certainly not them railways."
"But Tiffany's different," his wife continued. "What she's going to do I really don't know, though I do hope in time that she and Preston might settle round here. If he's a doctor and she's a witch, that's no reason why they can't be together, is it? Tiffany could have children too, then, like Hannah and Fastidia." They thought of their other daughters, of their grandchildren. Joe sighed.
"She's not like our other daughters, love. I believe Tiffany may even surpass her grandmother," he said. And then he blew out the candles. And they slept, thinking of their Tiffany, a skylark among the sparrows.